From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and a number of progressive Democrats say it's time to embrace a single-payer health care system. Medicare for all. The government runs it, no premiums, no co-pays, and everyone gets covered. And the cost? Well, a new report from a conservative think tank says north of $32 trillion over 10 years. But the same report says it would save $2 trillion over the same time. So Sanders says, bring it on. We'll talk to him and the author of the report this hour, and we'll be talking about putting a price tag on Medicare for all. You can join us on air or online. Are you for Sanders' single-payer Medicare for all plan? Do you trust the government to run your health care system? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org and on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we're going to be talking with Senator Bernie Sanders, but joining me first from Washington is Dylan Scott. He's healthcare policy reporter for Vox, and you can find a link to his story, Bernie Sanders' $32 trillion Medicaid for All plan is actually kind of a bargain, at our website, onpointradio.org. Dylan, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about the cost in this new study of Bernie Sanders' plan, remind us what this plan would do. What is Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All Act of 2017, which is backed by a bunch of Democrats? Tell us what it would do.
So Medicare for All, as envisioned in the Sanders bill, would be a total overhaul of health insurance in the United States. After a transition period, which the bill does allow for, almost effectively every American would be covered by a single government insurance program. And so, you know, the work that or the health insurance that people get through work, people who are currently covered by Medicaid, people who currently buy their coverage through Obamacare, all of those people would be moved on to a new government program under Medicare for All. And so that would obviously be a significant overhaul of the system as it exists today. There'd be a fair amount of disruption to the insurance that people currently have. The other kind of big piece of the Medicare for All plan and one of its more ambitious elements is that the benefits provided by this new government plan would be much more robust than the insurance that most people have today. Most care would be free at the point of service, at least. You wouldn't have to pay anything when you go to the doctor or go to the pharmacy necessarily. And the kinds of medical services that would be covered would be much more extensive than a lot of plans that we have today. So every American would be covered by this government plan eventually, and this government plan would cover almost any kind of health care that most people would actually need. There are a few allowances in the bill. The Veterans Administration would remain in place, so veterans would still get their health care through the VA. The Indian Health Service would remain in existence. But for all intents and purposes, almost every American would be covered by a government plan under Medicare for All, right, which actually kind of makes Medicare for All a bit of a misnomer because Medicare, as it exists today, is not nearly as robust as the health insurance that Bernie Sanders is laying out. But obviously, proponents of this plan know how popular Medicare is politically and as a program, so it makes sense that they have tried to attach themselves to the Medicare brand.
All right. A couple of specifics about this plan. So advocates argue that the program would help in particular young, low-income, self-employed workers who are among the tens of millions who are underinsured in this country, and it would also help 30 million Americans with no health insurance at all. What about the 156 million or so Americans who get their insurance through their employers? Life changes for them in a big way, right?
Absolutely. And I do think that's the big question for this, for a proposal like this, both programmatically and politically. To your point, you know, just the kind of administrative lift of getting 150 million Americans who are covered by this entire ecosystem of private health insurance plans onto one government insurance plan is going to be a big change. Yeah. And, you know, I think there are going to be, you know, this is where we really are getting down into the weeds, and it's hard to know until we're debating a real bill that might actually become law. But there are probably going to be some winners and losers for those people moving from work insurance to Medicare for All. There's probably some people who don't have that great of insurance through their work. And we've seen in some of the surveys and some of the research that increasingly people who have insurance through their work are asked to pay more money out of pocket, to pay higher premiums. And so for some people, moving into a government program where you no longer have premiums, where you no longer have out-of-pocket costs, could end up being a pretty good deal. On the other hand, there are certainly people who have very good insurance through their work right now, who might like their insurance very much and would therefore be kind of perturbed at the idea of being forced to switch over to a government plan. And maybe the benefits aren't as robust as what they currently have, or maybe they have to end up paying a little bit more money, whether that takes the form of taxes or something else. Obviously, financing is a big question for any single payer proposal. So,
right,
you know,
we're going to get into that in a big way, because I want to talk
absolutely.
About this plan this study that just came out from the Mercatus Center about how this would, how much this would cost essentially, and what it would mean to taxes. But first, Dylan, I want to just stick with this idea of winners and losers in this idea. Big losers, I think it's fair to say, health insurance companies would mostly be eliminated, and executives among the highest paid in the nation would lose their jobs, right?
Of course, yeah. There's how we make that transition to kind of more or less eliminate a multi-billion-dollar industry and what that means for our economy while kind of subsuming that industry's functions into the government is that's kind of in a lot of ways the whole ballgame, I think, for single payer, because that's the biggest programmatic change. And politically, people get nervous about change. At the least, a lot of people, I think, mostly feel fine about the insurance they get through work. We did a series of focus groups last fall, and that's something we found regularly, is even if people didn't love the insurance they have through work, they're probably okay with it, and the idea of a big change is scary to them. So I do think politically that's a challenge. In terms of winners and losers, maybe one simple way to think about it, we actually got a recent study, not the one we're talking about today, but a study of what single payer in just New York State might look like. And the gist of its findings was people above 125 people and families who make more than $125,000 a year are probably going to be losers. They're probably going to end up paying more money under the New York vision of single payer than they do now. On the other hand, and that's a lot of people, of course.
Yeah.
On the other hand, people who make less money than that would probably end up saving money. So the distributional changes are definitely going to be a big question to solve, both as a matter of policy and in terms of how the politics of this play out.
All right. So now comes this analysis from the libertarian-leaning Mercatus Center. This is at George Mason University, and we're going to talk to the author of this report in a bit. But I want to sort of talk to you about what we've gleaned from this report. What did it find? First, start with the price tag, because you hear this number, and it's being kicked around a lot, especially by the critics, $32.6 trillion over 10 years. My God, it sounds impossible.
Right. It's a big, scary number.
Right.
I think that is absolutely true. So yes, what the folks at George Mason found was that over 10 years, if you implemented, they more or less tried to score the Bernie Sanders bill specifically. And what they found is if you implemented it over 10 years, the cost to the federal government would be $32 trillion, which is a lot of money. And obviously, any new government spending needs to have new government revenue in order to pay for it. And that's where we get back to the financing question.
Right.
I do think there are different ways, though, to look at $32 trillion. And I think what stuck out to some people, including people who support Medicare for All, is that, yes, the federal government is going to spend a lot more money, $32 trillion, because now the federal government is covering tens of millions more Americans than they do right now. But what the proponents of the plan kind of latched onto in this George Mason report is if you look at the healthcare system as a whole, spending is actually
money.
Going to
right.
Spending
it goes down
is actually
$2
trillion
over
down
the same
a little
period.
Bit.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so when you also account for the fact that more people are going to be covered and more services are going to be covered, it starts to look at least, you know, hypothetically, like a pretty good deal. Now, there are a lot of questions. One of the assumptions that the George Mason research baked in, and they did this because it was stipulated in the Sanders bill, was that healthcare providers would be paid at Medicare rates. And now Medicare rates are a little bit better than Medicaid, and they're worse than private insurance. And so healthcare providers would probably be looking at a pay cut under the bill as Sanders has written. And so there's certainly a question of, is it really politically palatable to give all of America's doctors and hospitals a pay cut. And so if you end up adjusting the payment rate, that's going to end up adjusting the price tag. And so that's where it becomes very important. All the details become very important when we're actually talking about a bill that becomes law. But yeah, looking, just kind of taking the Sanders bill and the George Mason analysis on its face, I think there's at least a case to be made that this is actually a pretty good deal, even if there are some outstanding questions, of course.
Right. And that was sort of the thrust of your really interesting article. So just to summarize, it would save $2 trillion over 10 years. But and here's where the sort of big political thing is. $32.6 trillion of spending essentially gets shifted from the private sector to the government sector. So what
exactly.
This is going to come down to is the public really ready to trust the government with running the healthcare system and the kind of government expansion that would represent? I mean, that's really what the political debate is about, right?
I think that's true. Absolutely. And there are obviously, once you talk about the cost, you have to talk about the financing. Obviously, they're going to have to be new taxes to pay for a $32 trillion healthcare plan. And then again, it kind of becomes a question of how you think about it. On the one hand, and the financing is sort of the least well-defined part of the Sanders bill. They have some ideas about, you know, basically premium taxes on employers, maybe a smaller one on households, maybe you increase taxes on the wealthy or expand the estate tax. They have a bunch of ideas. They haven't really worked out this is exactly how we would pay for it. But the point being, you know, yes, there's going to have to be $32 trillion in federal spending. Yes, that means taxes are going to go up for some people by some degree. This then becomes a question of, so how much spending are you just replacing? Because right now, you know, businesses pay money on premiums for the health insurance they provide to their employers. Their employees, of course, spend money on premiums. We're all already spending a lot of money on healthcare as it is.
Right.
And if now this money is just going somewhere else, if it's going to the federal government instead of your private health insurance, that's how the losers and winners are really going to shake out. And I think that remains one of the most fascinating questions as these proposals continue to gain steam.
Really, really interesting. Dylan Scott, healthcare policy reporter for Vox. Stay with us. Listeners, we're putting a price tag on Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicaid for All plan. We'll be talking to him after the break. Polls suggest most Americans support a single-payer plan. Do you? We'll talk with Sanders after the break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the debate over a new report on Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan. You can join the conversation. Do you support his proposal to have the government run the nation's health care system? Dylan Scott, healthcare policy reporter from Vox, is with me. And joining me now from Burlington, Vermont, is independent Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
So what's your reaction, first of all, to this study from the Mercatus Center that your plan would cost the government $32.6 trillion over 10 years, require a huge hike in taxes? Is that a fair assessment? What's your response?
Well, my response is that according to the report, over a 10-year period, we save, S-A-V-E, $2 trillion and do away with the obscenity of the United States of America being the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people as a right. Let us be very clear, and I think some of my conservative friends are trying to confuse the issue. Right now, by far, we spend more money per person on health care than any other country on earth. According to the OECD, it's not even close. We're spending twice as much per capita as do the Canadians and the British and many of our industrialized allies around the world. So two questions, two issues. Do we guarantee health care to all people as a moral right? Yes. Do we end the absurdity, in my view, of spending twice as much per capita on health care as do the people of any other nation? Yes, we do that.
Yeah.
Now, how do you do that? Well, obviously, you have programs like Medicare right now, which happens to be the most popular health insurance program in the country. You have the Veterans Administration, which, among other things, happens to be the second most popular health care program in the country. And what we ultimately say is we're going to expand Medicare to guarantee health care not only to people over 65, but everybody else in the country. Now, people say, well, taxes are going up. Federal government is going to expand. That's true. But what people, my conservative friends, do not talk about is that if you are a family of four today, your average family of four, who is self-employed, you're now paying $28,000 a year for private insurance. A Medicare for All program ends all of those premiums, ends the deductibles, ends the co-payments, very substantially lowers the cost of prescription drugs.
So, Senator Sanders, let me run in. You mentioned higher taxes. I want to see if you're more or less in line with what the Mercatus Center said. They came up with this figure that to pay for this, taxes, corporate taxes, individual taxes, all taxes would pretty much have to double or more than double. Is that more or less
right? No, I don't know that that is the case, but this is what I do know.
Yeah.
If you are that family of four paying $28,000 a year, you're not going to be paying that. Yes, you will be paying more in taxes, but you're going to be better off at the end of the day because you're not paying private insurance. Right now, Anthony, we have millions of people in this country who actually have insurance, yet they don't go to the doctor because they can't afford the deductible or the copayment. We're going to eliminate that. We're paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. We're going to end that as well. We waste in this system an enormous amount of money on the profiteering of the insurance companies, of the drug companies, of the huge amount of administrative waste. Talk to any hospital. Go into any hospital, and you'll see a significant parts of their cost not providing health care, but doing billing. Talk to any doctor, any nurse, spend an enormous amount of time arguing with insurance companies. There are enormous wastes in the system that can be eliminated by a Medicare for All program, which is why, by the way, more and more people are supporting it.
Yeah. Senator, I want to ask you about another concern that I know we're going to hear about when we talk to the author of this study of your plan, and that is your plan would cap reimbursements to doctors and hospitals for services at the Medicare rate. This would increase, according to this report, this analysis, this would increase demand for healthcare services while simultaneously cutting payment to providers by up to 40%. And the concern here is it might drive healthcare providers away, reduce the quality of the care they provide. What's your response to that?
Well, what you just said is increase healthcare demand. Is that what you just said?
That was one of the, that is, yes, it, that is
that
part
is
of the concern.
Well, yeah. It's not a concern to me. What you are really saying is that there are millions of people today who desperately need health care, who need vision care, who need audio care, and they're not getting it. So, no, I do not think it is a terrible thing. I think it's a good thing that people today who are suffering, who are sicker than they should be, who in some cases are dying. Let's be clear. Under the current system, thousands of people, probably tens of thousands of people, die each and every year because they don't get the health care that they need, and by the time they go to the doctor, it's too late. We have people going into the emergency room at huge expense because they don't have access to a primary health care physician because we have a dysfunctional system which does not work to provide quality care in the most cost-effective way, which building a strong primary care system, by the way, would do, but worries more about tertiary care and hospital care.
Yeah. Senator, I know your time is limited, and I just want to ask one more question. It seems like, and Dylan Scott and I were talking about this before you came on, it seems like the big issue here is, how do you convince Americans, and Americans who are, especially Americans who are benefiting from the current system, to trust the government to run a program this size, to buy into the idea of government expansion? I mean, are you confident that Americans will buy the idea of paying significantly higher taxes and hand over to the government a program that would cost something like $3 trillion a year?
Well, Anthony, let me reverse that question and say, do I think the American people will be supportive of a program which says you're not paying any more premiums, outrageously high premiums, premiums which are going up every year, to private insurance companies? You know what? A Blue Cross, Blue Shield, United, they're not particularly popular institutions because people understand the function of these companies is not to provide quality care, but to make as much money as they can. Their CEOs make outrageous compensation, amounts of money in compensation. So yes, I do think we will win this fight. I think we have come a long way over the last 2 years. And I think we will continue to make progress. In fact, a whole lot of people around this country are running on Medicare for All. And the reason they're doing that is they sense that that is what the people of America want.
I was going to ask you that, and I will let you go after this question. Is this a winning issue for Democrats in 2016?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. Guaranteeing health care to all people is a right, not a privilege, and doing it in a far more cost-effective way than the current dysfunctional health care system, which leaves 30 million uninsured, 50 million underinsured. Yeah, Medicare for All is a winning program to run on.
All right. Bernie Sanders, independent senator from Vermont and the author of the Medicare for All Act of 2017. Senator Sanders, many thanks for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Dylan Scott, a healthcare policy reporter for Vox, you're still with me. Give me your thoughts about what you just heard.
Yeah, I mean, I think what something that you've seen happening in 2018 is Democrats are increasingly comfortable making the case for Medicare for All. And obviously, nobody does that better than Senator Sanders, who has been supporting this idea for a lot longer than a lot of other Democrats. We saw it when almost every kind of any Democrat in the Senate who people think has a legitimate interest in running for president in 2020 has signed on to Senator Sanders's bill. As he alluded to, there have been a number of notable primaries with Democratic candidates, one who supported Medicare for All, one who was a little more ambivalent, who maybe supported improving Obamacare or protecting Obamacare. And in several cases, in several notable swing districts that'll be crucial in November, the Medicare for All candidate won. And so this was an idea that a few years ago and even during Senator Sanders' presidential campaign was viewed as a little more fringe. It hadn't quite entered the mainstream. I think it's safe to say now, even if it's far from certain that Medicare for All will become national policy and anytime soon, that it's at least become a mainstream and more politically palatable idea. And I do think some of that is people have started to really reflect on whether everyone should have a basic right to healthcare. And if your answer to that is yes, then it at least becomes interesting to entertain the idea of a single payer system where you eliminate uninsurance, eliminate medical debt, and make sure that access is secured.
Dylan Scott, stand by. I want to introduce from Baltimore, Charles Blahaus. He's a senior research strategist at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and he's a former senior economist, economic advisor to President George W. Bush, and the author of the new working paper we've been talking about, The Costs of a National Single-Payer Healthcare System. Charles, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really interested in talking to you. You heard Senator Sanders there. He didn't seem to take issue with your study. He made the point, yeah, it's going to cost a lot of money. Yeah, it's going to raise taxes, but it covers more people, offers more services, and costs less. $2 trillion over 10 years, according to your report. So is that a pretty fair summary, or what's your response to what you heard from the senator?
Well, I'm obviously delighted to hear my study being cited by people on different sides of the debate. I would want to be a little clear about one thing. The study found that the Medicare for All aspects of this, and or the aspects of going to single payer and its effects on utilization, minus potential savings from lower administrative costs, and at least under my assumptions, very aggressive savings with respect to drug prices, that actually would cause not only federal spending to go up enormously, but also national spending. The key with respect to the effect on national spending is what happens to provider payment levels.
Yeah.
And the text of the bill specifies providers would be brought down to Medicare payment rates. Those are about 40% lower than they are in private health insurance. So there is a scenario in the report that shows if you cut payments to providers by 40%, not gradually but immediately, then of course, yes, national spending would go down about 3% or so relative to current projections. But that's not a function of Medicare for All. There's actually another scenario in the report that's equally a single-payer estimate in which national expenditures go up when those provider cuts don't take place. So this really comes down to what you think will happen to provider payment levels. And I want to be clear that my study is not stipulating that the single-payer itself would bring down national health care costs.
I see. Okay, well, that makes an interesting point. You heard Senator Sanders say, though, when I asked him about seeing payments essentially going down to healthcare providers consistent with the Medicare payment scheme. One of the things in your report, you said that that is going to essentially drive more people into the system and possibly drive doctors away and lower services. But Sanders, we heard Sanders say he welcomes that because that's an indication that there's a need out there that Medicare for All would respond to.
Right. Now, I think, obviously, I didn't write this paper to make dispositive value judgments on what national health policy should be. I'm really writing something that tries to apply numbers to the state of our understanding of what happens when you provide first dollar coverage of a wider range of services. And obviously that causes utilization and demand to go up. Now, obviously some of that will be for needed and desirable and necessary services. The literature, though, is very clear that that utilization goes up irrespective of services value, efficacy, or necessity. So,
right.
So it's going to go up across the board, and overall, it's not necessarily an increase in terms of efficiency with respect to our national health spending. But regardless of whether you make the value judgment that the additional spending is needed and necessary and good, or some of it is wasteful and unnecessary and causes backlogs, it's still there.
Right,
and
got
we
it.
Should know that it's there.
Let's go to Byron, who's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Go ahead, Byron. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Anthony. I was calling because I don't think it's even about the cost so much as, even though it is cheaper. I think it's a matter of government priorities. Do we want to spend money to give health care to our citizens and save the lives of tens of thousands of Americans every year? Or do we want to spend that money on aid wars abroad, a drone program that kills over 90% of the wrong people, on a war in Libya where there are now open slave markets, in Syria?
Byron, I get it. It is a question of priorities. It's also a question of whether Americans are ready to expand the government in a huge way. Because Charles Blahaus, I mean, you know, what I come away when I read your report, when I hear Senator Sanders, that's really what we're talking about here. We're talking about an enormous expansion of the role of the federal government, which is also an expression of its priorities, I guess. But speak to the caller. What do you think?
No, I think you've summarized it about as well as I could. I think it's not just a matter of prioritization. It's not really feasible to scale back other federal spending to the extent that would be necessary to pay for this. I mean, we tend to have knockdown, drag-out fights over changes of 1 or 2% in federal spending and revenues as a percentage of GDP. Here we're talking 12 or 13%. So it's not like we're going to shift spending from other federal priorities to do this. This would be a transformative, qualitative change in the size of the federal government.
Hmm. Dylan Scott, I'm curious about this. We heard Bernie Sanders talking about this as a winning issue for Democrats. I'm curious what the polling tells us. In other words, when someone says, yeah, I'm for a single-payer system, and we know that polls say that, are we sure that people really understand what that means and that along with it comes this huge expansion of the role of the federal government?
That is a great question. And frustratingly, the polling is a little bit mixed depending exactly on how you look at it. I think we can say a couple things clearly, though. One is that Medicare for All, those three words, is very popular. There was a recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll that found it had the support of nearly two-thirds of Americans. When you describe it as single-payer health insurance, as Kaiser did in that same survey, it still has pretty strong support. I believe it was 48% approval, 30% disapproval, and the rest were undecided. And so that still shows pretty overwhelming or pretty solid support for single payer described as such, but it obviously doesn't quite match the levels of Medicare for All. The other thing that we've seen is that I think opinions on this are pretty clearly still malleable. If you present people with new arguments, it could swing them in favor and it could swing them against. On the one hand, if you tell them, to your point, Anthony, it's a takeover of government takeover of health insurance, support goes down. If you tell people that every American would have health care at little to no cost to themselves at point of service, support tends to go up. And
All right.
So that's why this ongoing debate is really important for setting those political parameters.
Really important, really interesting. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about healthcare, specifically about the cost and potential savings of Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan. You can join the conversation. Are you for it? The government runs Medicare now. It's popular. Why not offer it to everyone? Or are you concerned about higher taxes and a huge expansion of the federal government? So I want to hear a little bit of sound that's related to this subject. New York Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez shocked the nation with her June primary win. Here she is on CBS's Face the Nation last week talking about the issues and strategies that led to her success.
The factors that ultimately created our win was the fact that we had bold commitments, and I campaigned on hard commitments of Medicare for all, tuition-free public college, ensuring a Green New Deal for our future, and championing those issues were the reason that we won.
Now, a number of Democrats across the country are running on the Medicare for All as a campaign issue in the primary season. Now, here's another point of view. In a health care debate last September, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham used his closing remarks to explain why he thinks a single-payer health care system would harm America.
Obamacare is a placeholder for Bernie Care. Bernie Care is socialism full-born. He's a nice man, but if you want Medicare for All, you're going to wind up with Medicare with nobody. You'll have a card without a real choice. Don't consolidate all of your hopes and dreams for your family into the arms of the federal government, because it's not going to work.
All right, two views there. My guests today are Dylan Scott, healthcare policy reporter for Vox, and Charles Blahouse, senior research strategist at the Mercatus Center and author of a new working paper about the cost of Senator Sanders' Medicare for All plan. Let's take your calls. Let's go to Suzanne. She's calling from Grinnell, Iowa. Suzanne, you're on the air. Good to have you. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Well, a lot of the conversation about the cost, who's winning and losing, there was a talk about the people who have health insurance through their corporate pay-ins, I mean, that they're providing by their employer. We could also flip that around. That's going to be a huge savings to the people who provide that to their employees. And they're now going to be in a better competitive situation vis-a-vis, you know, our European allies that don't have to shoulder that burden of paying for the health care costs of their employees. And I also want to say I'm calling from the heartland, and I am a business owner, but I don't employ regular help. But in the heartland, it would make a huge difference for the spillover effect, because a lot of couples have one spouse working for the sole reason of because they're independent and they have to be in the independent market for health insurance. So that health insurance is the sole reason they're being employed in town and as farmers. And
yeah.
So they
Suzanne, you put a couple of issues on the table that I want to take up and get to. I'm going to take one more call and then come back to these issues that you raised. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Teg, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Teg, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just a senior citizen, 72, and I added up my premiums and my long-term care, my meds, all the costs. I'm paying $600 a month, which I luckily can afford. And I would just be delighted to get a small discount and pay that into the federal government, just so they would say, we'll take care of you, right to the graves, to the nursing home. You don't have to worry. You just go. I'd be happy to pay into that situation. And one other point, Medicare is a great tool to get standard costs in hospitals, so that a total knee in Georgia would cost $18,000, and in Wisconsin it would cost $52,000. They can be a great tool, and Medicare for All would be a work in progress. The the Lindsey Grahams of this world, they obstructed Obamacare instead of trying to make it better.
All right, we got it, Teg. You're in favor of it, and we hear you loud and clear, and I'm really grateful to your call. Charles Blahaus, I want to come to you and ask you about the point that Suzanne from Iowa made, and that is, wouldn't a Medicare for All, or talk about the effect on businesses who now have to spend so much on providing health care plans for their employees, wouldn't this be a tremendous savings for them?
Well, I think actually not just Suzanne, but both your callers spoke at least somewhat to this point, which is that there's two sides to this coin, right? I mean, you're on the one hand dramatically increasing people's tax burdens and the amount of federal spending. On the other hand, you are lifting from individuals and businesses sort of the daily burden of you know, financing these things out of pocket or through their employer-provided benefits or what have you. And the question is, how are people going to feel about that trade? An analogy that I sometimes make to help people think it through, it's sort of like, imagine the government comes to your door and says, okay, we've totaled up everything throughout the year that you are spending on food, and we think we can do it more efficiently than is being done at the restaurants and the groceries and through farms and everything. We're going to do it all for you. Just let us raise your taxes by that amount of money, and we promise to cut the payments to restaurants and groceries and farms by 40%. And if we do that, we might be able to shave 2 or 3% off the total amount that you're paying. And the question is, would people happily pay that much more in taxes on the promise that the government would be able to do that? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that reasonably frames the choice. I don't think we can assume that people would necessarily be comfortable with that, even if you assume the government was going to be able to produce these dramatic provider cuts.
Let's get another call. Sam is calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Go ahead, Sam. You're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
Hi, Anthony. I recently read that 85% of what's driving healthcare costs are lifestyle choices of people. And in all this discussion, it's like a four-legged stool where we're talking about three legs: the insurance companies, the hospitals, and the doctors. Well, what about people's individual choices and what it's doing to healthcare costs?
Sam, it's a good question. Dylan Scott, what do you think about, are we missing one of the legs on this stool, according to Sam?
I do think that's a great question, and we've seen, I think, in the research that there's a lot of promise in the idea of preventive medicine, of trying to help people stay healthy so they don't get sick and cost a lot of money later. I do think it's an open question of how much a single-payer health insurance program would do to actually address that. Obviously, right now, some private insurers certainly do wellness programs and things that are designed to achieve that goal. On the other hand, I think single-payer supporters would point out part of the reason that we have so many chronic conditions and part of the reason that people get sick and end up costing the system a lot of money is they don't get healthcare earlier. They don't just get their regular primary doctor checkups and that sort of thing. And part of that reason might be the cost to them or because they're outright uninsured right now. And so if we're able to give them insurance and able to give to them free at the point of service, maybe we'd be able to catch things earlier or actually prevent them. And that could have savings down the line. I don't know how that shakes out, but I think it is a really important question that single payer, both opponents and supporters, are going to have to try to answer.
And Charles Blahaus, a very quick final comment from you. It's interesting to me that the two sides in this debate can look at your study and come to opposite conclusions. Proponents can say, advocates can look at your study and say, yeah, we get better outcomes, we insure everyone, we offer more services, we eliminate premiums, we save $2 trillion. Opponents look at it and say, yikes, big price tag, higher taxes, what a mess.
Well, it is very gratifying, honestly, and obviously, as an analyst, you want to make sure that your work is accurately understood and represented, but to the extent that people on different sides are using this to help inform their discussions and arguments, I think that's fantastic.
All right. Charles Blahaus, Senior Research Strategist at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He's a former Senior Economist and Economic Advisor to President George W. Bush. Thank you so much, Charles, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Dylan Scott covers healthcare policy for Fox. Dylan, always great to have you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you much.
In a moment, we'll talk about a growing abuse and addiction problem with a commonly prescribed drug, gabapentin. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. There's a good chance you've heard of gabapentin, a drug commonly prescribed for nerve pain and epilepsy. It's one of the most widely prescribed pills out there, and it's safe if taken properly. But it's also easy to abuse. Across the country, healthcare workers and law enforcement agents say an increasing number of addicts are using gabapentin to get high. Joining me now from Washington is Carmen Herrera Rodriguez, a reporter for Kaiser Health News. You can find a link to her story. New on the streets, gabapentin, a drug for nerve pain and a new target of misuse. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Carmen, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So tell us a little bit about gabapentin, what it's normally prescribed for. Give us a little bit of understanding about this drug.
Sure. So gabapentin is a medication that's approved to treat epilepsy and pain related to nerve damage, which happens in folks with certain conditions like diabetes and fibromyalgia. It's also been used by a lot of doctors to address other health issues like a mood stabilization technique and for folks that are actually in recovery from alcohol dependence.
All right. So how are people misusing it?
So people are misusing it by pairing it with opioids in order to enhance the high of the opioid. They're also using it in order to kind of stave off the effects of withdrawal or just kind of have a euphoric effect if taken enough of it when they don't have their drug of choice.
Yeah. Now, you wrote about the growing problem of gabapentin abuse in Athens, Ohio. How did you come across this story, and what did you see when you went out to investigate?
So I came across a story by looking at the counties that the CDC identified as being at risk of having both an opioid addiction outbreak and an HIV outbreak. And from there on, I spoke to different people and did some research and happened to find Athens, Ohio. And Athens is, in terms of the gabapentin misuse problem, really beginning to understand what's going on. Law enforcement officials are still kind of trying to grapple with how to handle it, especially because it's not a drug that's scheduled by the federal government or in their state. Health counselors there are trying to make sure that people that they're caring for in recovery are actually adhering to their recovery, especially when gabapentin isn't a drug that they particularly, that they regularly test for when screening for any drug use. So it's something that's still very much on the cusp of the epidemic that we're seeing across the nation.
I see. I want to listen to a little bit of sound here. Here's Doug Crowley. He's a recovering heroin addict who had turned to gabapentin to ease his withdrawal. He described this in an interview that aired Tuesday on Boston's NBC 10, explaining what the drug does and how easy it is to get.
They're a dollar a piece for 800 milligrams, which is the biggest they come.
I've never felt in danger taking Johnny's. I've never felt like I was hurting myself. And I don't think anybody on the street does either. There's a part of you that knows you could die every day. And there's a part of you that accepts it. If it wasn't gabapentin, it would have been something else.
So I'm interested, Carmen, what we know about how people are getting the drug and why it's so hard for law enforcement to track and control.
So with the person I featured in my piece, Sierra Smith, she actually managed to get the drug through a prescriber. She went to several doctors and managed to get a prescription. And then from then on, she ultimately started misusing the drug. I also spoke with some other women in the recovery center where Sierra was at as well. And they also said that they received it from prescribers or they received it from other folks that were using other medications and abusing them. And they took it in order to stave off their withdrawals, kind of make them stable between hits of their preferred drug. And in Athens, according to the Ohio Board of Pharmacy, a 300-milligram pill of gabapentin can be sold for as little as 75 cents. So even if you don't have a connection with a prescriber or with someone who has the drug, you can easily get it from a dealer with very little money.
Hmm. And what do we know about the long-term effects of abuse of this drug? Tell us a little bit about that.
That's still something that's a question for doctors in terms of trying to get a hold of what's really going on. So one of the big questions is exactly how it enhances the high that's created by an opioid. And although we haven't seen any deaths that we know of related to gabapentin, and specifically a gabapentin overdose, because it is very hard to overdose on it, we have seen a large proportion of overdose deaths in some states that reported to have gabapentin in their system alongside another substance.
All right. Well, that's Carmen Herrera-Rodriguez. She's a reporter for Kaiser Health News. You can find a link to her story, New on the Streets, Gabapentin, a Drug for Nerve Pain and a New Target of Misuse, at our website, onpointradio.org. Carmen, thank you so much for your help today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for your time, Anthony.
Well, that's it for today. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Follow me on Twitter at Anthony G. Brooks. Finally today, I want to take a quick moment to say thank you for listening and for sticking with On Point for these last many months. You will soon be in great hands with our new hosts, Meghna Chakrabarty and David Folkenflik. And before I head off for a summer break, I want to say a big thank you to the On Point production staff. They are behind the scenes, too often unrecognized, but they are talented, dedicated, and essential. They're here every morning before the sun is up. They're still here long after we go off the air, coming up with the ideas, doing the research, booking the guests. And despite a long period of uncertainty, through no fault of their own, they kept this ship on course and on point. And for that, I'm truly grateful and mightily impressed. So it means a lot when I say On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardinsky, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alexander Schroeder, Grace Tatter, Kyrie Thompson, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Caroline Anders and David Marino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thank you all. And thank you, listeners, for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Thank you.